independent media is more important than ever. We don't have a corporate network behind us, and we also don't have big green foundation grants. So we really do need you, and we are actively calling in your direct support so that we can continue exploring many of these topics and perspectives often sidelined by mainstream media. If you're enjoying our show, please make sure you're subscribed and join us on Patreon today, starting at a tip of just $3 at patreon.com/greendreamer. Every little bit helps and really adds up, and that is the power in community. So thank you so much for however you're able to support our work.
We didn't evolve to know about this much pain. And of course, throughout time, there's been cultures that have been destroyed, mass slavery, you know, there have been huge, huge collective traumas. We're modern people with enough privilege to be able to watch the news and, you know, take it in, then it's so easy to get overwhelmed. How do I keep myself sustained? How do we keep each other sustained? This polycrisis that we're in is going to go on and on and on.
You're listening to Green Dreamer, and I'm your host, Kamea Shane. Today, we welcome Sophie Banks, whose eclectic life has been guided by an overarching question. What helps humans to create healthy, joyful, life-affirming ways of being? And why do we so often not, even when we really mean to? She's looked for answers in the worlds of engineering, grassroots football, psychotherapy, wisdom traditions, social movements for change, and more. She was one of the architects of the transition movement, and her current work focuses on two areas which feel vital in these times: recreating practices of shared grief tending and exploring healthy human culture, the culmination of her life's journey so far.
So part of my journey was always moving between the outer. You know, if we can even separate outer and inner, I think we do it a lot in kind of, you know, originally European culture, how the church and the scientists made a deal in a way to keep spirituality and science in two separate institutions that wouldn't interfere with each other. Whereas for a lot of people throughout time, the idea of separating the material world and how we make things from our relationship with spirit would be inconceivable. I had both of those trainings, and then also the kind of personal working as an individual therapist, but seeing how much of what people are impacted by, how they behave, how they respond, is actually to do with the systems that they're part of. So both systems of family, if they have one, and culture and schooling and education, but also the kind of ancestral lineage, the lands, the landscape that they're part of. And I think I've always been somebody, you know, that's interested in seeing patterns and looking across, you know, if it's like this over here, how is it like that over there, or how is it different? So, and what I saw, especially in transition, is that people were talking about, in the transition movement that I was part of for some time, people were talking about whole systems, but they were just talking about outer. They were just talking about peak oil or climate change or resource use or things that were in the physical world. And they weren't talking so much about process or worldview or why we've made technologies the way we have. So I was always trying to put these things back together, because I think whichever bit you leave out is the bit that's going to end up creating the result that you don't want. It's going to be out of awareness. And the things that are out of awareness, we can't shape or have a way of being in relationship with. And if it's out of awareness and it's got a destructive element to it, it will be destructive and you won't be able to see it. So that was always that my sort of impulse, was to ask what's missing, what's not being seen, what's not being included. And the second part of your question was about trauma. And I think it's good to really ask what we mean by trauma, because it's a word that is used by different people in many, many different ways. And a lot of people are talking about trauma or writing about it. So for me, trauma, I guess how I use the word, is to talk about something that creates an overwhelming experience, and an experience of feeling overwhelmed, powerless, terrified, and isolated, from which there is no return path. And for me, it's this possibility of speaking about an event that might be shocking or violent, or it might be a chronic erosion of one's well-being or self-worth, from which there isn't a repair, there isn't a healing. And it's that second part that, you know, we can have shocking or violent events or things that are wearing over time, but then a repair happens. So there's an intervention from outside. There's some support from outside. A space is held in which this body or these bodies that have experienced something can metabolize that experience, can make meaning of it together, and can restore a sense of trust both in myself and ourselves, those that have experienced it, but also in the holding field, in the wider community or the family or the healers or the society that I'm a part of that says, we care, we see that something's wrong, we see what happened to you maybe, and we want to help you. And we're here and we're going to hold you in love until you're back to a state of well-being, which you won't be the same as before, but a basic state of trust. And I think when we have those systems of repair, and most of us will have experienced some of that, when we have that repair, actually, that's when we're really growing in resilience, not just individually, but together. What we learn is that together we can cope with extreme situations and still recover and go forward in life well. And what happens when we don't have those repairs or those healing processes or ceremonies or whatever it is, we're left not only with the shock of the original event, but also with a rupture to our trust in the holding of life. So a sense that I couldn't cope, but that those around me don't care enough. I'm really curious if that's where the kind of narcissistic wound, the sense of worthlessness, actually comes from. It's the failure of return paths, the failure to repair. And there's a kind of fundamental rupture in trust in life or spirit, that something bigger holds me, cares about me, and is there for me when I need it. So I'm interested in speaking about trauma or thinking about trauma as a rupture in relationships, rather than just the original shocking event, which is often how it's framed. Something bad happened and then I was traumatized. But when you put in that second stage, something bad happened and then there was no repair and then I was traumatized, then it's much easier to see why it's a collective issue, because usually that repair needs to come from outside. So one part is the question, why was I, why did the event happen? Why was there sexual abuse? Why was there a violent attack? Why was there racism and microaggressions all the way through, somebody's experience as a person of color? Why did that happen? And so much of the violence and shock comes from societal or wider systems of racism or colonialism or patriarchy or inequality or poverty or disability, oppression, but an accident happens, a natural disaster happens, but often people are still left without a repair. And that's always, for me, a collective issue. What are our technologies? How do we notice? How do we put in place systems? And what does it mean that it is so normal that the repair doesn't happen? And for me, I don't always get the quote exactly right, but Reshma Menakem puts it beautifully. He says, trauma decontextualized in a society, in the wider society, looks like culture. So this sense that it's culturally normal not to repair, not to offer deep counseling and support to veterans returning from war, not to be a response when a child is sexually abused, that in the Catholic Church it was normalized that nothing would be done. And when we really reflect on that, when I reflect on that, that's the thing that is most shocking about it, is that it's become normal that these injuries are not attended to. And I think that's, for me, that's the most helpful definition of trauma. There's injuries happening that are not tended to.
Thank you for sharing this. To kind of deepen these connections, you explore the parallels between nervous system states for individuals and collective behavior patterns. What do you feel called to share about this? And I wonder if this might speak to any systemic vicious cycles going on, meaning societal and systemic contexts that are more likely to spark certain nervous system states for individuals, and then how that might be more likely to feed into collective behavior patterns that are considered less healthy. There seems to be ongoing vicious cycles of injustice socially, economically, and ecologically, and beyond in many ways. And I wonder if the states of our nervous systems and what that means for our collectivity plays into these trends as well.
So when I did a therapy training 25 years ago, I didn't learn so much about nervous systems or about trauma. And I think it's much more understood in kind of Western or global North culture now. And the role of the body in healing and healing from trauma. I got really interested in archetypes. So I kept coming across these pairs of archetypes that were kind of definitional about what is health in different systems of thought or different cultural traditions. And I got really curious. So, you know, in my psychotherapy training, they talked about will and love, will and love. And then I read a book by Martin Luther King, who talked about strength and love as being the two necessary things to hold together in activism and effective struggles for liberation. And then, you know, I talked to a Chinese medicine expert who spoke about yin and yang. And in Sibonfu Somme, one of my teachers from the Dagra people of Burkina Faso, she spoke about fire and water as the two key elements to hold in balance to create health. So these are kind of archetypes that I was finding in very different cultural paradigms. And I got curious at one point whether they related to the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system and this sense that it's not just that what our body is doing is being organized by the autonomous nervous system. So the nervous system that is out of awareness, it's autonomous, it's running itself. It's not in my control, even though I can, to some extent, be aware of what it's doing. And that's not only organizing what my body is doing and what my heart rate is, or whether there's lots of energy going to my muscles, or whether I'm relaxing and calming or sleeping, but it's also organizing what I can perceive. So a lot of this vagus nerve that's, you know, a large part of the autonomous nervous system is about what I'm receiving, what information is coming in. And out of the mass of information, what my brain is actually going to notice and perceive. So what I can perceive is also being organized by the state of my autonomous nervous system. And that felt really helpful when I started reading polyvagal theory by Stephen Porges and Deb Dana, who's, you know, helped to translate that and make it more accessible. And to see that there's a kind of ground state, and I'd met it in nature connection work that I had learned from John Young and Art of Mentoring, that there is a kind of natural ground state that's low energy, low stress, a basic state of trust where we move easily from action to rest in cycles. So from the more sympathetic, outward, moving, mobilized state to parasympathetic, relaxed, soothing, resting, recovering, digesting. And that can be with others or on my own. But this sense that that's a state of regulation. You know, when shocks come in or stress comes in or conflict, we start to go into fight flight, and we may go into fawn and freeze. And there are other stress states that have evolved to allow us to deal with stressful situations. Many of them to do with our evolution as social beings. Normal, so long as we can come back to this ground state, you know, which requires a basic sense of ease and trust and relaxation, relaxed action and relaxed digestion and resting. So that's what I started to understand as being the kind of patterning of healthy cultures, is that we have processes, technologies, rhythms, rituals, you know, what habits, whatever you want to call them, that support us to move between these different states. And whether that is the ritual of getting up in the morning, or, you know, how we greet each other, how we move from solitude to connection, how we prepare ourselves to go out in the day, how we gather in our day at the end and digest experience, how we hold healing ceremonies if somebody's experienced something out of the ordinary or stressful, the group processing of group experience. All of these things are part of what makes a culture. So a culture that can keep its people co-regulated, so supporting each other to be coming back to this state of basic trust, basic relaxation, competence, self-confidence, mutual confidence. That for me is the essence of a healthy culture. And cultures start to go out of health when there are dysregulated nervous systems. So there's fight or flight or freeze, especially if we get all the way to freeze, which is the most extreme response to shock or violent situations. And there's no return path, then we get left with these residual states of fight, flight, freeze, fawn, other possible ones. They're the ones that I've understood the most. And now we have bodies walking around with unmetabolized stress states and the feelings of terror, of powerlessness, of isolation, of broken trust, possibly worthlessness. And the structures that emerge in our psyche to try to manage that. One of the recent things that I've been learning about is internal family systems and this idea that there are the exiled parts and the protector parts. You know, these structures emerge to try to manage life when we can't get back to a basic sense of our own goodness and the goodness of what is around us. And I just want to say, you know, there, for me, there's always spectrums. It's not like we either have that or we don't. You know, probably every society has got some bit of needing to manage life. We don't always get life to meet us exactly as we want. But the more unprocessed stress, the more unprocessed pain there is in the bodies, in the society, the more that pain will come out and be acted out in unhelpful ways. You know, one way I could manage my stress is by putting it into your body. So if a group has more power, more physical power, more financial power, more military power, you know, a group of bodies could put it into another group of bodies. And I think it's an interesting way to look at colonialism, for instance, that colonialism isn't just about extracting resources. It's also about exporting feelings of shame and powerlessness and poverty and helplessness. Is that true? You know, I'd like to start, it's coming a bit later, but I like to keep asking that question. Is it true? I think it's an interesting question to ask. And, you know, sometimes we turn the pain in on ourselves. You know, in modern culture, there's a lot of self-harm. There's a lot of substance abuse, or there's a lot of addictions. You know, in order to manage my unmanageable pain, I'm going to overwork. I'm going to keep running away from it. So we can see the patterns of flight or fight. I'm going to try to control everything. I'm going to get enough strength that I never feel powerless again. You know, I'm going to appease people. I feel powerless. So I'm going to just try to give away my authentic needs, my own sense of self and empowerment. And sometimes these are really good strategies. You know, these probably have kept me safe. And in a system where there is a lot of power, unevenly distributed and often being held not in caring or clean ways, you know, we need these survival strategies. And I think it's a sign of a culture that has gone a long way from, you know, what I would recognize as health. And I think what a lot of cultures throughout time would recognize as health.
You're listening to Green Dreamer, an alternative podcast made possible by listeners like you. To support our community-powered show and listen to our disruption-free, extended, and bonus episodes, Join us today on Patreon at patreon.com/greendreamer. There is so much grief and pain in the world right now, in what feels to many like an era of mass death and destruction. What have you noticed as some notable trends of how many people in dominant cultures process their pain and grief? And how does this relate to our tendencies and capacities to either reinforce and continually create or otherwise disrupt cultures of destruction?
I feel incredibly blessed and privileged to have come across grief tending work through Sobhonfu and Maladoma Somme from the Dagra people, but also from Joanna Macy, you know, who came through a kind of activist culture, the need to feel our pain for the world, to be moved to stand for it and take action for life on earth, to feel ourselves as connected. And then, you know, other teachers that I've learned from, Frances Weller, Maeve Gavin, Martine Prechtel. And, you know, for me, grief tending is one form of a return path when we're carrying pain, when there's unmetabolized experience in our bodies. But what I see when we hold grief spaces, shared grief spaces, I sometimes think we've privatized grief in the modern world. So, you know, if you're privileged enough, you might be able to take it to a therapist or have some support, but it's often in one-to-one spaces. And actually there's something about sitting in circle or, you know, holding a ceremony with others where we move from being the one who's supporting and holding to the one who's falling down in grief. And then we come back and then we support the next person. That I think is a really strengthening experience. And for many people, it can be quite radical because we're either the professional therapist or we're the broken client or, you know, the patient or the whatever. And actually to say we're all both and we can just move from one to the other. And that's really good to be able to do that. I think is strengthens each one of us. Yes, I'm the holder and I'm the broken one. But also there's something about when we hold pain collectively in some way, that we can hold things that are too overwhelming to hold on our own. And like you say, you know, the amount of pain, the amount of suffering that so many people are experiencing, it is too much. And it's part of the reason why lots of people are numbing out or distracting themselves or, you know, doing some of the flight, I'm switching off. It's not because they don't care. It's actually because they care too much. You know, this is what Joanna Macy used to say, you know, it's not about apathy, it's about overwhelm. So then we need to have a space where there's enough support, enough time, enough resource to go towards big issues, the collective pain, the deep wounding that are just in us, that are being experienced. And, you know, there could be lots more to say, isn't it? It could be another whole podcast about grief tending and its practice. But part of what I see is that when we do that, it's an incredibly beautiful, nourishing experience to be with other human beings, hearing the depth of their truth. Even if it's painful, actually, you know, I regularly come out of grief tending circles, short ones, long ones, feeling something of my faith in humanity is restored. Feeling a deep sense of love and connection for the other people that I've been with, even if I've only met them for 4 hours online. So there's something about the practice of hearing each other's pain that I think weaves us back into trusting, loving human beings. And I just see it happen again and again with people that have never tended grief, people that have never sat in circle, people that have done years of it. It just seems to work. And again, I think it's part of why I believe it's in us, it's naturally in us. You know, our ancestors learned to do it and they somehow managed to pass it on. Because it's even on, like, how do we do grief tending on Zoom? You know, I think we can do it because it's such a part of who we are and we're longing for it. Not everybody, you know, nothing's for everybody. But the people who come, you know, people that are drawn to it. It's like, oh, finally, you know, I've got to the water and I can drink. And I think there's such a shortage of spaces where we can really be truly authentic with each other and speak about how I'm broken and how I had a breakdown and how guilty and ashamed I feel of parts of myself, or how much hatred I have, or outrage or disgust. It's like, where do we get to share that with people in a way where it's accepted and we've all got it and it's fine? As well as, I love, I care deeply, you know, I'm beautiful, you're wonderful. We've all got capacity, you know, we're all holding each other because we just care. We care. That's so natural.
Right. As you've written, I've spoken about trauma as not just the overwhelming event, not just the shock, but the failure of that return path, what I've called the return path of pulling back, end quote. With so much having been scaled, with the internet enabling global communication, and also with systems that tie the global economy together, these days, instead of people only having to process pain and grieve things at a more community and human scale level, a lot of us are having to sit with and deal with grief at levels that I don't even know if we've ever had to deal with in the course of deeper human history. With this, I wonder if you've thought about our nervous systems' capacities to process the pains of learning about mass destruction at the global scale, and what could more affirming ways of tending grief and sharing grief look like for people wanting to alchemize that in different ways?
The main thing that I want to say, this balance between how resourced I am, you know, how connected, how much loving support I have, how much beauty there is, you know, whatever it is that nourishes and holds me in life. I really love this word, you know, holding, to be held in life. What does that mean? You know, this sense that I'm connected. There are relationships where I can show up, but also where there's caring that comes towards me, or beauty or something nourishing comes towards me, and that I can offer my nourishment and beauty and love and care out to others. So, you know, I can feel it's like my body's moving, but, you know, this sort of web of tendrils that go out, of threads that go out that actually hold me in life. And that when I have enough of those, and when we come together in circle and we call in support and we name all the things that nourish and help us and hold us, and the not just in the present, but teachers and practices and all the different dimensions of our being, then we go towards what is painful, you know, and we can dive into the water of grief, or flow in the river of grief, and metabolize it through our bodies and acknowledge it and care for it. And, you know, with this, and often with a wider holding, inviting ancestors or elements or the land or the water that is with us, and this sense of being part of these much greater bodies through time. And then there's a process at the end of when we have shared grief in whatever way we've managed to do it, that we come back, that we soothe, that we take time to integrate, that we, you know, possibly make meaning of what's been shared, so that we go forward changed by the experience, you know, reconnected, but also understanding a deeper sense of what it is to be human, what it is to be human in these times. There's something about this balance of what holds me and what I can tend to, what holds us, you know, how we resource ourselves, what we can face into and metabolize, and how we come back out again. And there's a courage in keeping on facing into, like you say, the overwhelm of information, of distressing information. And there's something about moderating or managing how much of that we take in, because I think that's so true, isn't it? We didn't evolve to know about this much pain. Of course, throughout time, there's been cultures that have been destroyed, mass slavery. You know, there have been huge, huge collective traumas that the individuals that are being enslaved or destroyed have had to deal with. You know, could anything be more overwhelming than that? We're modern people with enough privilege to be able to watch the news and, you know, take it in. Then it's so easy to get overwhelmed. You know, for me, this is one of the absolutely key questions of our time, is how do I keep myself sustained? How do we keep each other sustained? This polycrisis that we're in is going to go on and on and on. That I don't think there's any right answer, but burnout and exhaustion and overwhelm are such pressing issues, you know, for those people that have capacity, that have the choice to care and give their lives towards tending it in some way. So yeah, you know, how we come together and remember to celebrate and be in gratitude and honouring and thanks and touch beauty and love each other, say thank you.
Well, Green Dreamer, we are coming to a close here, but we will have more references and resources from this episode linked in our show notes at greendreamer.com. And for now, Sophie, thank you so much for joining us on the show today. It's been an incredible honor to have you. As we wrap up, what final words of wisdom do you have for us as Green Dreamers?
My wish and prayer is for people to be well and connected and supported, and please don't burn out, you know, and to take burnout seriously and to keep pulling each other in, to keep pulling each other in to care and, you know, supporting and sustaining each other and finding the ways that we can do that in these times.
Green Dreamer is a community-powered podcast made possible by listeners like you. To support our work and tune into our extended and bonus episodes, join us today on Patreon at patreon.com/greendreamer. Our production manager and researcher is Anissa C. Mohali. Our writer and audio editor is Yasmin Danoon. And I'm your host and producer, Kamea Shane. Thank you for tuning in, and we will catch you soon in our next episode. Ewanishkaya, ne wo ne ha.